Hello and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond. This is the show in which we usually chat about the movies or films that you'd forgot you'd even seen in the first place. And I am usually joined by my co-host, Joe Devine. He is here.
Usually,
and he's, yeah, that's usual. Everything's usual, except again, we're doing Top Trumps again. Although one of the listeners did email in and suggest that was a shit name for the
what did they say?
Let me read out the whole email from Ryan Casely. Hey gents, long time listener, first time writer, and this email does actually factor into something that we've got lined up. I just wanted to say I was listening along to the newest pod episode while recovering from my recent hernia surgery. Don't get a hernia, wouldn't recommend. Sorry to hear about that, Ryan.
I've got a hernia, you know. It's really annoying. And when I read that email, I was like, fuck off, Ryan. I have an active hernia. And don't tell me not to get one because the surgery's bad. I already have one and I don't want it. And I don't want the surgery and I hate you.
I'm going to hate him more in a minute. I thought I could reach out and add one onto your top Trump list. See below. Cheaper by the dozen. Now, this is interesting, Ryan, because we've recorded a Cheaper by the Dozen episode, and that's partly why the Top Trump episode came out last week, because Joe hadn't got around to editing that, and we'd recorded the Top Trumps, and I was going on holiday, and he was a busy boy, because he was live on stage in Walthamstow at Soho Theatre. And he was really stressed, and I said, "Joe, don't worry about it, mate. I'm gonna hurry out this edit, even though I'm going on holiday quite soon, and I've got lots of packing, and my wife booked the holiday, and that's a big thing. She's booked the I haven't done anything, so I need to start pulling my weight. Don't worry, I'm gonna edit this episode, and we're gonna have a show for our fans."
Yeah, you're sort of like a hero, aren't you, really?
Well, yeah, and then this is a Russian doll of a story. I got the edit done, and I sent it to Joe, and I said, "Joe, we're flying tomorrow. I'm not going to have time to upload it. Do upload it for me." And Joe said, "Thanks, mate. You've saved my bacon. I will upload it." And he did upload it, not before interjecting a editor's note about a film fuck-up that I made up in the episode. Now, we've never done that before to each other. The edit suite is a sanctuary. You know, whoever edits the episode kind of calls the shots. Not even kind of. He does. I like to cut out all my "ers," and Joe likes to cut out all his own racial epithets. I'm joking. He doesn't. So... To listen back to Joe edit in him pulling my pants down.
What did I get? Yeah, I remember doing it, but I don't remember what the oh yeah, it was the Graduate song.
I made a joke and I said, "Oh, don't be silly, of course I wrote it for the film." That wasn't the crux of my argument. But anyway, so back to the point. Back to Ryan. Ryan says...
Oh, Ryan. I was thinking they were called Reagan or something.
Ryan. So, Cheaper by the Dozen. I'm really glad I watched that in line for some nonsense chat around how Alan Ruck featured and how that makes it culturally relevant, in line with Succession, and then inevitably how Adam hates it because of the thickos love it and means you can't enjoy something. I bet he also probably hates pizza for a reason of the same name. Anyway, I like the innovation on new games. Kevin Bacon game, great. Top Trumps needs work. Oh, so he wasn't even slagging off the name. He just says the game needs work.
It says the game needs work.
Fucking hell, mate. So not only do I just hate popular things, but I come up with shit formats. Keep up the pods, though. Always a good laugh, which I'm not supposed to do after this surgery. Yeah. So be less funny, a.k.a. don't let Tom Hardy's mum back in. All the best, Ryan. So he does finish on a kind thing.
It's worth saying though that he's really got you there, because I would say of all the people I know, you are the most likely to dislike pizza on the basis that it's just cheese on tomato sauce on bread, and that you could make your own, and you don't understand what everyone's going crazy about, and the Italians need to get another meal, mate. That sort of thing, you know.
That's a shit parody of my voice, but I love pizza. I love good stuff that people like. Didn't I WhatsApp you the other day where I'd made some cheese on toast and I said, "Fuck me, cheese on toast is amazing. It's basically pizza, isn't it?" And we agreed that cheese on toast was as good as pizza. So we're just going to go straight in this time.
Great.
Colin has randomised a new deck for me and Joe. He didn't include last week's films.
There is one new rule, but I'll explain that later in the episode when it becomes relevant.
Yeah, and as Joe said again in the other episode, who wants to learn new rules when you're playing a game? Playing the game is the game. So we're going to rattle through. The criteria are box office, critical acclaim, cultural penetration, industry influence, career catalyst, rewatchability, social and political impact, franchise impact, innovation, and fan base loyalty.
Quick question for you, Adam. I know last week, you, or 2 weeks ago, you wrote your movies down on sweet little cards, didn't you? Have you done that this week, or have you just have you given up and let the crafty dream die?
I've got a deck of cards. I use cue cards. Last week they were blue, and this week I've gone for green. I've kept last week's. They're on my desk, and I'm going to keep them as mementos of just the fun times we're having.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll let you know that I haven't got any cards, but I did ask Colin to randomise the list you sent me, so it's appearing in a random order. And I think I went first last week, didn't I, with Top Trumps? So I think, as we get started, maybe you should go first this week.
Well, I was going to say loser goes first. That's how I used to play a game.
Yeah. And by that, do you mean the loser of the game, or do you just mean loser? Because if that was it, then you would also still go first, right? So I'm just not clear on which one you mean.
I mean the loser, the person who lost the game last week.
Right, yeah. And by the game, do you mean when we played Top Trumps together last week, or do you just mean by the game of life? Because again, if you mean that, then it would be you that went first in the game. So can you just clarify?
I don't feel I should have to, because we're playing the game Top Trumps, the game of the same name. And so that's who lost at that. You lost at that. So then you should go first. It's a kindness.
No, that's true. That is true. If kindness was a score, a category in this game, and you had your own card. No, I'm just curious. I want to get started quickly because I really want to hear which incredible films you have on your list this week that I don't have. But I'll happily go first if you want me to.
Okay, right, I'm going to go first.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say my film, and my film is Babe.
Oh, what a great movie.
Pause. Oh, Letterboxd. Letterboxd is my only app that's on, you know, the bottom bit of your phone.
Yeah.
Yeah? That's there's no other icon at the bottom of my phone. It's just Letterboxd.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's absolutely psychotic, man. I've never heard anything as meant. I'm not even doing a joke. That is one of the most insane things I've ever heard. I've got phone, I've got internet, like browser, I've got messages, and I've got WhatsApp. You just have Letterboxd there.
Yeah, and then the rest of the screen, you've got the other icons, but I don't want anything other than Letterboxd on. And I'm saying that this is not sponsored by Letterboxd. I don't know how many episodes of this show we have to do for me not to say that.
You're a fucking lunatic, man. That is loony behaviour. Oh, wow. Okay, well, let's make some use of it today. You'll be reading your blurbs from Letterboxd. I'll be reading mine from IMDb, of course, which I've just researched on the internet. I haven't even downloaded the app because, you know, I don't need to.
Babe, the 1995 flick directed by Chris Noonan. I've never heard that name before. Have you ever heard the name Chris Noonan? Because I haven't.
Only when I researched who directed the film Babe a few weeks ago.
A little pig goes a long way. Babe is a little pig who doesn't quite know his place in the world, with a bunch of odd friends like Ferdinand the duck, who thinks he's a rooster, and Fly the dog he calls Mum. Babe realises that he is the makings to become the greatest sheep pig of all time, and Farmer Hoggett knows it. That'll do, pig, that'll do.
Can I take issue with that blurb, just briefly, to say, it's actually, I think, one of the best things about the film Babe. I talked about it a bit on a recent podcast because I rewatched it fairly recently. And the connection I made at the time was that it must be Wes Anderson's favourite film. But one of my favourite things about Babe is the story of Ferdinand the Duck, who doesn't, as the blurb say, think he's a rooster. Ferdinand the Duck does the best job he possibly can to get up earlier than the rooster, to get to the top of the farmhouse to crow before the rooster does every morning, in order to give himself a purpose and a usefulness. Because his contention is that animals that do not have a use are killed and eaten by humans, which is what happens to pigs. It's what happens to ducks. The roosters get to live on because they're waking people up in the morning. The sheepdogs get to live on because they're herding all the sheep and the cattle. But if you're a poor duck or a poor pig, unless you can find a purpose in life, you're going to get eaten. So he doesn't think he's a rooster. He intentionally tries to be one due to an existential crisis about a very rational issue.
And that is the most you'll hear anyone say anything about the film Babe. Apart from me... I went and saw that when I was, how old? I was 1995, so I would have been 14 years old. I went with a girl and we just got off for the entirety of the film. And I think I might even have got a hand job throughout Babe. So that's what I think of when I think of Babe. It doesn't score high. It does not score high on anything. Really. This is a stinker of a card. And I think that's fair because I think it's... I've never rewatched it. Why would you?
It's so good. It's a really good film.
I tried rewatching it with my kid when she was 5 or 6, and it was just in my face, a scream of a film. Colin doesn't get franchise impact. Its franchise impact is one. It got a sequel.
Yeah. Babe, Pig in the City is quite important culturally as well. A lot of people, you'll hear a lot of people talking about Babe, Pig in the City.
Yeah, it's one of those odd, dark sequels. George Miller of Mad Max Fury Road fame, made it. I missed when we were chatting about The Incredibles versus 2001, and 2001 had franchise impact very low. I completely forgot and missed that there's a sequel to that. And you tried to suggest that it was pristine because it doesn't, and there is a sequel to 2001.
Right.
So in terms of pulling your pants down about The Graduate, did you know there's a sequel?
No, didn't know.
Yeah, 2010. So anyway.
Sure.
I mean, this is, can you tell me your card? Is that part of the game? You should tell me your card. Of course, I need to know your card.
Do you?
Yeah.
Right. Is that what we did last week?
No, you're right. I just thought I'd try.
We didn't do that. You're just trying to trick me into giving you my card.
Yeah. Okay. So, fuck me. Industry influence. This is... Okay, fine. Let's just go rewatchability. Rewatchability 7.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that you do lose this round. You're a bit unlucky, actually, because I was about to take issue with Colin over the scores that my film has. My film is 2023's Past Lives. Nora and Hae Sung, two deeply connected childhood friends, are wrested apart after Nora's family emigrates from South America. 20 years later, they are reunited for one fateful week as they confront notions of love and destiny. Now, for my money, and maybe this is where this game becomes quite interesting. For my money, Past Lives is probably the best film I have seen released in the cinema in the last decade, maybe. I think it's absolutely magnificent. Every time I watch it, it moves me indescribable amounts.
But we're talking influence.
We're talking influence. So, in a number of these categories, it scores very low. So obviously, box office, it scores 2. It has a pretty low cultural penetration of 6, which is maybe fair. I don't know.
It's pretty kind. It's going to have high critical acclaim, though, right?
Yeah, it only has 9 as critical acclaim, which only? I think is low. I think it has 10 critical acclaim. I think it won Oscars, it was only nominated for 2. Maybe it didn't win any.
No, I don't think it won enough to get.
Maybe
10.
It's fine,
Come on, it's not the fucking Godfather.
Rewatchability. It has 8, which I think is. I think is low. I think the film is eminently rewatchable. I don't think anything is spoiled the first time round.
How many times have you rewatched it?
I have rewatched it 2 or 3 times, so I've seen it overall 3 or 4.
I haven't rewatched it, but I think that's fair. That's fair enough. I mean, Babe scores total 58 out of 100.
Past Lives scores 59.
I mean, that's a low, that feels like a low score. I mean, does it even make sense? For this episode, I really wanted us to match up films and can kind of compare them against each other as films on their own merits. Now, this is Babe versus Past Lives. Feels like exactly the kind of thing I wanted, and yet I've got no interest in talking about them against each other.
I do, because I would say I think both scores for me are low. I think these are two films that maybe it's a generational thing, right? You're an old millennial, maybe on the edge of Gen X, let's say. For me, when I was young and I watched Babe as a child, it made a huge impact on me. It left a real imprint on me as well. There's a kind of sadness and an ennui to Babe that appears in many of those like 90s children's films and children's TV series, particularly the ones that were made or set in England. There's like an incredible bucolicness to Babe. I think it's beautiful. It's mournful. It's very poignant. It presumably has very high cultural penetration. I was kind of surprised that you didn't pick that, because I think even just the final line, "That'll do, pig, that'll do," is one of the most quoted lines from cinema that I can think of.
It scores a 6.
That's nonsense, right? For me, there's two lines from cinema. There's "Say hello to my little friend," and there's "That'll do, pig." There's nothing else.
You want a flag ass? Okay, have to play with you. Come on. Okay. Do you
want to
play rough? Okay.
Uno.
Say hello to my little friend! Do you
want
to play rough?
That'll do, pig.
Say hello to my little friend!
Hey, it kind of looks like Mr. Garrison.
Oh, gee, isn't that an amazing coincidence? What are the odds of that? You boys get first prize.
That'll do, pig.
Say hello to my little friend!
Call me as soon as you can, Peter. And I really hope you find your real father.
We're gonna miss you, Dad.
Come back soon, Daddy. I love you.
That'll do, pig. That'll do.
I mean, just to take issue with the Englishness of Babe, it was filmed in Australia. It's a very Australian film.
Sure, I know, I understand, but it's set in England.
No, it's not. It's set in Australia. Why is his wife Australian?
No, it's not. It's set in England.
Do you think?
Of course, it could be set in New Zealand, maybe, but it's definitely not set in Australia. They're all English.
What, the animals? It's an English
pig. All the animals are English. Is Babe set in England or Australia? Let's find out. The movie Babe is set primarily in Australia, although the film itself draws from a novel set in the English West Country. So the story blends elements of English and Australian rural life. While Hoggart Farm was constructed in Australia, the movie's aesthetic and some accents evoke a sense of rural England. You don't laugh at me like I'm wrong. The answer is quite literally a middle ground between the two. You can't laugh at me like I'm wrong.
No, I'm just funny. I'm just funnying. I'm just laughing at this is what our lives have come to. You going... I'm laughing at both of us. Me, mainly, the fact that I bothered to say, oh God, I've got to pull you up on something. I could have just let it slide.
Look, this is a terrible start for me. I'm furious because obviously I've won, but I'm not happy about it. And both films I love, and they both have shit low scores, and it's ridiculous. Past Lives, can you agree with me though that Past Lives is one of the best films of the last 10 years?
I need to rewatch it again. I thought it was fantastic, and that's all I can say. I think I need more time. When did it come out?
2023.
Right. Ask me in 2030 and I'll let you know.
What? Come on. You'd love it if you watched it again. If you watched it again tonight, you'd love it. All right, moving on. It's my turn. It's 1-0 to me because I'm about to press ahead real hard. I know this is a straight up dub for me. It's going to be 2-0 in just a minute because my next movie is Anchorman from 2004, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. In the 1970s, an Anchorman's stint as San Diego's top-rated newsreader is challenged when an ambitious newswoman becomes his co-anchor. Directed, of course, by Adam McKay, with Will Ferrell starring alongside Christina Applegate. I could pick this for a number of things. Career catalyst, it's 9. Rewatchability, if it hadn't been taken, is also at 9. Fan base loyalty, as we've discussed numerous times before, is at 9. But we all here know, Adam, that I'm picking cultural penetration because it's a 10 and Milk really was a bad choice. What have you got?
I've got Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh,
and yeah, it's not got the cultural penetration of Anchorman. I think it's, you know, sadly the underappreciated, more forgotten great Coen flicks, and it only gets a 6, and I think that's a fair score. It gets a total score of 60.
It gets 6 in cultural penetration.
Yeah, which is actually maybe a bit high.
How is it culturally penetrated in any way?
Well, I think people still watch it, and it's very well regarded. I mean, what do you want me to ask him?
Maybe, yeah, because my understanding of cultural penetration is not just that people still watch it or that it's well regarded. I would have thought rewatchability is people still watch it. Critical acclaim is it's well regarded. I'd love to know, like, what's quotable or memorable about the film that's sort of, has it been parodied? Has it, you know, existed in other forms? I don't think it has, right?
Let's find out. Colin, great question. That 6 for cultural penetration might feel a little generous at first glance, so let's break it down. Oscar Isaac's performance is now iconic within cinephile culture. It is definitely him and the cat. The cat is iconic. The soundtrack, especially the T-Bone Burnett Marcus Mumford produced folk revival, has enduring fan appeal. And I actually quite like... Oh, yeah, the Adam Driver... That's that sequence with Adam Driver and Justin Timberlake and Isaac, who comes up, and Adam Driver's going, or Rocket Man. What is he saying? What's the bit he does?
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't remember because it didn't culturally penetrate me.
Okay, don't be a cunt. You've won the round. What's your favourite... Between Inside versus Anchorman, there's more depths to Inside Llewyn Davis. The humour is richer than Anchorman. And Inside Llewyn Davis has never had a horrible fan base of dickheads who claim the film for their own. So these are ticks in my mind. You know, there's a moral victory.
Are you setting me up for a joke there, that last one?
No.
Because I only know one person that really likes this film, and it's the horrible dickhead who claims it.
Oh, that's lovely. I tell you, I wasn't setting you up for a joke, but I was. It sounds like, you know, you're not that fussed about Anchorman. Do you not think one of the great comedies of all time? No?
Do you know, it's really hard to say what one of the great comedies of all time is.
Yeah.
Because I think comedy is so subjective. And I think one thing that has changed a lot about mainstream cinema in the last 20 to 30 years is that the boundaries and the borders between drama and comedy have really dissolved in a way that perhaps wasn't as much categorically the case in the 80s and earlier. So I don't know what one of the best comedy films in the world. I know Anchorman is appreciated as such. I know at the time I really, really loved it and really enjoyed it. Has it stayed with me? No. Can I watch it now and enjoy it as much? No. And for whatever reason that's down to... That just is a truth, right? I don't think it's survived in the same way.
But they don't make funny films anymore. They don't make comedies like for the very reason that you said, like comedy and drama, the fucking dramedy on telly and then also in film. Like, nothing can just be the thing. It's like, oh, well, let's add a little bit of humour in there. And there's no, you don't get Mel Brooks.
Yeah, like I watched A Real Pain the other day.
Right.
That's a perfect middle ground, right?
That's perfect, perfect boring ground. Just be funny. Not funny, not emotional. Rubbish, a fucking, such a rubbish, dull film. And people will lap it up. It's like, can we have some comedies back? Can we have the comedy back, please?
Yeah.
Ring up Judd Apatow.
Let's make another Shanghai Noon.
Okay, round three. Oh, man, my deck. My fucking deck.
Is it a shit deck?
I've got Ex Machina, the 2014 Alex Garland written and directed flick. Let's go to the Letterboxd. I love this flick. I'm a Garland guy. I'm on record. Anything that guy does, I'm into, and I'm an apologist for. Except, interestingly, Annihilation, which I don't like and won't apologise for. I won't apologise for not liking it or getting into it.
With Natalie Portman, the Netflix movie.
Yeah, yeah. The fact it went to Netflix just turned me right off it. There is nothing more human than the will to survive. Caleb, a coder at the world's largest internet company, wins a competition to spend a weekend at a private mountain retreat belonging to Nathan, the reclusive CEO of the company. But when Caleb arrives at a remote location, he finds that he will have to participate in a strange and fascinating experiment in which he must interact with the world's first true artificial intelligence housed in the body of a beautiful robot girl. And it's our second Oscar Isaac, Alicia Vikander, and Domhnall Gleeson. It's an amazing three-hander. And I've got quite a pick. I mean, it's pretty high industry influence and innovation and risk. And industry influence is one of those tougher to pin down ones. So I'm gonna plump it on that, and I'm gonna go 9 industry influence for Ex Machina.
Well, unfortunately for me, I picked the film Moneyball, which only has an industry influence of 7. Now, it's quite interesting that we get here with this game, Adam, because I think Moneyball is one of the most watchable films of all time. It's so easy to pop on. It is its duration matches every single flight from London to Europe that you can imagine. You pop it on, you press play after you've taken off, and it finishes just before you start landing. It's absolutely supreme. Okay, it's got Brad Pitt in it doing a great job, better than George Clooney would have done. It's sort of about sports, but not really, so you get to kind of enjoy that element of it. It's made in a really interesting way. It's full of these amazing, slick one-liners. Of course, it's about Oakland A's general manager Billy Bean's successful attempt to assemble a baseball team on a lean budget by employing computer-generated analysis to acquire new players. It feels newsy. It feels happening. It's got Aaron Sorkin as part of the script-writing team, and it's based on a Michael Lewis book, which is, you know, an incredibly popular book. I love everything about it. I think it's one of the most successful films of the last 20 years, of being a really good film. It scores quite shit in most categories, and I wonder if that's, you know, that's where where this game and the scores show something interesting about modern films and the desire for modern films. You know, we read all the time now about the watch hours of different movies and TV series on Netflix, and the suggestion that what audiences actually want is not, like, quote unquote, really good, high quality stuff. What they want is stuff that's sort of easy to watch and doesn't ask too much of them. And I mean, maybe I would put Moneyball as the very top of that category. To me, it feels like one of those quite good Apple TV series, like Severance or something, which is like very, very watchable, but ultimately like quite shit. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but Moneyball's not quite shit.
I think Moneyball transcends that. I don't think it is that shit, but like, the scores are, you know, they're across, it's like 6s and 7s across the board, basically. It's got 8 in critical acclaim.
Yeah, because this is about influence. There's only one criteria, which is about how supposedly good it is, and that's critical acclaim. What does it score in that?
Wouldn't you say rewatchability also, like, it's given it a 7 for rewatchability, which I think is low. I think this is one of the most rewatchable films ever.
Fine, you could bump that. I'd easily bump that up to a 10. But yeah. Rewatchability's gone.
I know. Right. But I'm still taking a chuff with it.
Fine, but the industry influence of Ex Machina. I was trying to dig into the 9 of it, and I couldn't see it. But you know, Colin's made me re-understand why it was so impactful on the industry. Do you want to know why?
Tell me.
It redefined low budget sci-fi. It was made for $15 million. And it showed how big ideas and minimal locations could compete with blockbuster sci-fi. Its success empowered more auteur-driven mid-budget sci-fi. It didn't spawn a franchise or shift the entire industry's business model, but in terms of creative influence on storytelling, tone, and sci-fi aesthetics, a 9 is well-earned.
That's really fair that they made it for $15 million. That film feels huge, doesn't it? I don't mean in terms of expense, but in terms of scale, that they made it, you know, and maybe that's got a lot to do with the helicopter scene at the very beginning of the film, where you see Domhnall Gleeson arriving at this sanctuary that the tech billionaire owner lives in. There's a great script exchange between him and the helicopter pilot. He says, you know, Domhnall Gleeson says, when do we get to his land? And the helicopter pilot says, we've been flying over it for the last 20 minutes. You know, it gives this impression of scale, whereas then the rest of the film does take place in one or two rooms. You know, they spend their money in the right place, don't they? It's very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, you could almost redo it as a play, and I'm surprised they haven't done that. So I'm going to take it, and if I... Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think we both know the answer to what you're going to plop on if you plop on the sofa.
I don't. This is the thing. I think this is the closest so far. I think Ex Machina is really super rewatchable as well, and easy to watch. I don't think it asks too much. I think I rewatch Moneyball more often, and I think on any given day, perhaps Moneyball would edge that slightly. But it's a close run battle for me. It's not as straightforward.
Well, I mean, I was purely talking in terms of how easy it is to watch, because Garland's a bit more challenging, and so. I was thinking in terms of the plop on effect.
Right,
it's the simpler film, and Moneyball is the simpler film, I guess. In this,
I mean,
this
I don't sense. Think it is. I don't think it is. I think Ex Machina is insanely easy to watch. It's not complicated in any way. It's tonally a little different, but it's not like it's a complex film. It's actually very, very simple. And whereas it pertains to be about science and maths and stuff, there isn't actually any real maths in it. Whereas in Moneyball, I don't know if you'll remember, there's a lot of numbers and maths that you don't understand. And the film does a great job of explaining them. So whilst Moneyball feels like the simpler of the two films, yeah, it's actually just made to feel simpler, even though it is really more complicated. And that's one of the great things about mainstream cinema, isn't it? It's not for everyone, mainstream cinema, because some people like to say that they like stuff that feels a bit more challenging, even if it isn't really. So it's each to their own, I suppose, isn't it? Some people like stuff that's really, really good. Other people like stuff that's just really good, but other people say it's really, really good, you know?
So it's Ex Machina for the win there. On to round 4.
That's right.
You first?
It is me first on round 4. Unfortunately, I have drawn a film that I haven't seen. So I'm going to need your help here, Adam, to expound on some of these categories. My film is the 1978 Halloween. 15 years after murdering his sister on Halloween night 1963, Michael Myers escapes, which is always funny to me because I just think of Mike Myers, escapes from a mental hospital and returns to the small town of Haddonfield, Illinois, to kill again. Obviously written and directed by John Carpenter, also co-written by Deborah Hill. It scores fairly well in some categories, so some that are already unavailable. Cultural penetration, it scores a 9, I think maybe for obvious reasons. There are a couple of other areas that it scores high-ish. Industry influences taken, it scores an 8 there. Rewatchability also taken, it scores a 7. I'm going to go with one of two, Adam. I'm either going to go with innovation and risk or fan base loyalty. And in both, it scores an 8. But do you want to say anything about the film Halloween before I pick my category?
It's Halloween, isn't it? It's old John Carpenter. Reinvented horror, you know? Made it simple and scary again.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I've never watched Halloween to completion, so...
Oh.
I'm a thing guy. I'm the thing guy as opposed to Halloween. My mate at uni, he watched it all the time. And for some reason, it became then a big blocker for me just to watch it at all. So then I just didn't. Mm. And I've just like kept it compartmentalized out of my canon. And for a horror fan, I'm a horror fan, to not have seen Halloween, I wouldn't say it at the meet and greets with the other cinephiles, with the other horror cinephiles.
It'd be the scariest thing said all evening, wouldn't it?
I'd just be persona non grata. I mean, for me, a horror movie, so much of it is in the anticipation and the surprise and the unknown. And because Halloween was such a big feature of, like, the best of films, and the mask, the Mike Myers mask was everywhere, like, I felt like I knew everything about the film before I saw it. So to watch it would just be just going through the motions just to say I watched it. And I'm just not that kind of guy. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to watch 2001 just to say I've seen it. I'm going to wait for someone who loves it to force me to go to the cinema and watch it with him whilst he looks at me watching it. I'm not, you know, so that's why I haven't seen Halloween. You know, that's a joke in Baby Driver.
Is it?
Yeah, it's the funny bit in that very shit film.
Oh, they get the wrong masks.
Yeah, it's a good bit in a very shit film.
That's how you know it's a low common denominator joke, because everyone's already thought of that joke and then they put it in a big movie. You know, what are you going to do? Okay, well, listen, I'm going to pick Innovation and Risk, which scored an 8. I'll save fan base loyalty for later. Adam, can you remind me, when you came up with the categories for this, what you were thinking of in terms of Innovation and Risk? What does that really mean in this context, and why would you say that Halloween scores as highly as it does?
Well, when I was thinking of it, I kind of was thinking, I mean, obviously, I just used Memento to kind of inspire a lot of the criteria. And, like, Memento was how it structured the story. But then that can apply to all kinds of different things, like how it was shot, how it was edited. I mean, also, like, there's, like, technical breakthroughs, like The Shining, you know, Kubrick invents the Steadicam on that, right? That's innovation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Right, yeah.
Does it subvert the genre? You know, that kind of stuff. Is it a conventional movie, or is it not? Is it something new about it? And is it risky?
Yeah. Does it innovate?
Is it innovate? Okay. Is it risky? I don't know. Like,
no. Do you know what? I think I've got it. I think I was thinking maybe it was more complicated than it is. I'm pretty sure I've got it now from what your descriptions of innovation and risk and what those words mean. So what film did you select, and have I beaten you?
This is interesting. I got Toy Story 3.
Oh,
if you'd picked fan base loyalty, you would have lost.
That would have been game over, absolutely.
Because that's a 10. Story, of course, Innovation and Risk for Toy Story 3 is only a 7. It's a sequel. There's nothing innovative or risky about it. Oh, actually, you know, to be fair, then where you think they're all going to die was quite risky. And I think so it gets a fair 7. But 8 for Halloween, it's a low-budget horror. John Carpenter's kind of creating a new cinematic horror language. It's innovative. It's a fair win.
That'll do, Pig. That'll do.
And now, you know, I'm staring down the barrel of 3-1 down.
Yes, you are. All right, well, before we move on to round number 5, I'd love to insert another game into this game. It's a classic Can You Best Me Bacon? Now, you did a question last week, Adam, whether it should be called Beat My Bacon, but because that episode hasn't released yet, no one's emailed in to say that's a good idea. So until someone does, it will be called Best Me Bacon. Today, I've got two, I think, tricky customers for you. I already gave you these actors 5 minutes ago to give you a little bit of thinking time because it's a difficult one. Toni Collette and Riz Ahmed are the two actors that I'm looking for you to make Kevin Bacon-style connection, movie connections between. So, for the audience's sake, Adam doesn't have to get this in the shortest possible route. All he has to do is beat my route, but he doesn't know how long my route is before he says his. So he's guessing blind. Now, Adam, over to you. Toni Collette to Riz Ahmed. What do you think? But two fine actors, by the way.
Two very fine actors. I prefer Riz, if I'm honest. Riz is a phenomenal actor. He's never mind fine. He's up there. He's even great in, say, like Rogue One. It's kind of confusing as to what his character is.
Sure.
He's got so much charisma and talent. Toni, I like Toni. I find that she tends to play a certain type.
A woman.
And a woman. But she's good. She's got chops. She plays that type well. So I went straight to the big flicks that they've been in. Toni Collette, she was in Mickey 17 recently.
Mm.
The Bong Joon-ho silly film that's like a million hours long. And then I thought Riz was in Venom with Tom Hardy. So I've got Tom Hardy at one end connecting, and then I've got who else is in Mickey 17? You got Mark Ruffalo. So Ruffalo's jumping out on me. So that's what I'm thinking. And I've made the connection fairly quickly after that. Do you want me to run you through it?
I do. Yeah, I want to hear.
So you've got Riz Ahmed is in Venom with Tom Hardy. A horrible film. Really shit. But Riz is pretty good. Tom Hardy is in The Drop with James Gandolfini.
Oh, I used that film last week, I think.
You saw that film?
Yeah, I remember. I think I used it for in the Cheaper by the Dozen episode. Whatever Kevin Bacon game we played there, I used that movie.
Oh, well, you've stuffed it in my bacon locker then, and it's been sat there waiting, and I'm plumping it out.
Nice.
James Gandolfini was in a little scene Robert Redford flick called The Last Castle. Do you remember that?
No, I don't think I've ever seen that.
It was late 90s, early 2000s, very early 2000s. It's one of Robert Redford's kind of liberal, he's a prisoner, and Gandolfini's the horrible prison warder. Well, who else is in that flick? Well, Mark Ruffalo's in that flick. It was an early Mark Ruffalo flick.
Oh.
So, and then it's Mark Ruffalo is in Mickey 17 with Toni Collette.
So that's 4. Well done, man.
Thank you.
That's a really good, I really like that route. You've beaten me. I did it in 5. Amusingly, one end of my route was the same as yours. So if I start with Riz Ahmed, I also went for Venom. Terrible film, shit film. Riz is pretty good though. Into Tom Hardy. And then because I kept thinking Toni Collette, who I actually started with, for Toni Collette, I thought I'll go with About a Boy because it's a British film and Riz Ahmed is British, and I'm sure I'll be able to find British connections all the way through here, which proved very difficult. So in the end, starting again with Riz Ahmed, I went through Venom, Tom Hardy. Tom Hardy, I went with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy to Gary Oldman. And this is where I had to use 2 steps to get to Toni Collette. I was hoping to do that in 1. But in the end, I went with Gary Oldman in the Harry Potter series with Ralph Fiennes, who's in The Constant Gardener, with Rachel Weisz, who's in About a Boy, with Toni Collette. So it was 5. So well done, you beat me.
Oh, I prefer your route. That's lovely. The About a Boy route. Hats off.
It is possible to do it in 2. The Oracle of Bacon website tells me that it is possible to do it in. It's possible to do it in 2 in a number of ways, actually. One with a film that did come to mind. I've never actually seen it, but I know that Riz Ahmed is in it. The Sisters Brothers with John C. Reilly, who's in The Hours with Toni Collette.
Oh, Sisters Brothers, that would have been a good shout.
There is Riz Ahmed in a film that I've actually seen called The Reluctant Fundamentalist with Christopher Nicholas Smith, who's in Enough Said with Toni Collette.
Any other tours?
There were a couple of other tours. There was some. I've closed the website now, but there was a route through Rogue One. I just can't remember the name of the actor that was involved, so you'll have to take my word for it.
Bonjour. Nice sweater.
It's round five, and it's your turn to pick first. A reminder, Adam, that the scores are 3-1, and industry influence, cultural penetration, rewatchability, and innovation and risk are all currently taken.
I've got a written list on a card, and I'm crossing them out. Pen and paper, my friend. It's old school, okay? And I'm picking my film, and it's Amelie.
Wow.
Yeah?
Sure. Yeah. Can I ask you, does this score 10 in every art student's favourite film when they're 15 years old?
I mean, I think that's a bit harsh.
It is harsh. I felt mean when I said it, but I feel that way.
I don't think it's a film student, but I think it was one of those films that it's more for people who want to suggest that they've seen more, they watch foreign movies. Oh, I've seen Amelie.
Sure.
Like, yeah. You know, they don't just watch, yeah. I don't want to like give you notes about your joke, Joe, because it was a good joke, but it felt like it wasn't grounded in reality.
I think I know what you mean by it not being grounded in reality. Maybe it would be better if I said this: it's the kind of film that people like when they also think that Ex Machina's sort of complex in some way. Those sorts of people. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. No, that's fair. Now, people loved Amelie when it came out.
Yeah.
People really took it to heart. And then I would say that there was a backlash to it, a little mini Juno-esque backlash. There was suggestions that it wasn't a kind of a true representation of that area of Paris. It was a very white in the movie, and it's more ethnically diverse in reality. And then people don't like it when films are successful. If something's successful, people go, oh, hang on a sec. Oh, you're Coldplay, fuck off, we hate you. You know, so Amelie was like the Coldplay of the time for a bit. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think that's very fair, very fair. I'm curious what you're going to pick it for, though.
There's only one place I can go. Like, whatever the backlash was, the critics fawned all over it. I'm pretty sure it did some kind of award, if not an Oscar. And so I've got to go Critical Acclaim 9. Mm. And I'm going to go Critical Acclaim 9.
Yep.
It's the 2001 French flick with Audrey Tautou about a kooky French chick. But it sounds twee and seems twee. And then when you rewatch it, there is so much. It's the film that Michel Gondry wished he could have made. It's like, it's actually good.
I love how much shit you give Michel Gondry. I feel like
so do I.
Of all the people that we speak to, you give Michel Gondry the shortest shrift for some reason, which makes me laugh a lot. Critical Acclaim is one of the categories that you can beat me in. I'm curious to see if you can guess, maybe not what the film is, but what type of film it is. If I tell you that this, my movie that came out in 2013, it scored 9 in box office, 10 in cultural penetration, 8 in industry influence, 9 in rewatchability, 8 in franchise impact, and 10 Whoa. In fan base loyalty.
Mad Max Fury Road.
It's not Mad Max Fury Road. It is Mad Max Frozen Road. Written, of course, by Hans Christian Andersen and some more modern people.
Frozen.
Yeah.
You got Frozen.
I got Frozen, yeah.
I bet you've not seen Frozen.
Well, I don't have a child, so no, I haven't seen Frozen. I can tell you that it scores just 7 in critical acclaim. So unlike the sort of earlier era of these Pixar movies that were also actually good, it only gets a 7 here.
You like musicals. I think you'd like Frozen.
I don't like the song Let It Go, though. I've definitely heard a lot of that, and that seems quite annoying. Mm. Do you know what? I don't like modern children's musical songs. I don't think they're very good. I think they've lost the art of... I think they've started to write music by algorithm and, you know, listen, sing me Colours of the Wind any day, mate, but not Let It Go. Pick it up and fuck off.
I mean, this is when the game is at its best, when a flick like Amelie can beat Frozen, right? Come on, because I'm losing every single other category if I don't pick.
Let me ask you this question, though. Critical. If there was a category here called there was a backlash against this film because of how popular it is, which one would win? Because these have to be surely two of the highest scoring films in that category.
Yeah, no, two as well. Because I think Frozen got a lot of shit as well.
Right.
Do you like Amelie?
I've never seen it.
Are you joking?
No.
Why haven't you seen Amelie?
Because of the people that liked it and watched it before I had the opportunity to like it and watch it.
Enough time's passed now. It's over 20 years later. No one's talking about Amelie anymore.
It's really, really stuck in my craw, that one.
Really?
Yeah, I think at a coming of age time, when I was, you know, as a teenager, the people that liked it and watched it, they've turned me off it, I think, maybe forever. I think I would either need to have a child and watch it with my own child, or I would need to be 75 years old and have survived like a terminal illness or something to go, yeah, let's stick on Amelie. I'm sure it's a delightful film. And I know the problem is all to do with me. And I want to emphasize before I get an email saying that it's because of some misogyny I have. Sure, maybe it is. I don't think it is. That could be an unconscious element involved. That's certainly not in my mind why I haven't watched it. There are other films that have male leads in that I feel the same way about and have never watched. I don't think it's anything to do with the fact that it's French. I think it's just to do with the place in culture that it occupied when I sort of turned the age that I might have started to watch it. And it's really, really jammed in there, you know?
I love that answer. I think I don't like the notion that it's delightful. I think that's the problem. There are things that are charming about it, but that isn't actually the essence of the movie. There's actually some little darkness in there. And, you know, you did make me watch all three Lord of the Rings movies back to back over... Two days.
What's your point? Be careful now.
I'm gonna play a card, Joe. Now.
What? I have to come to your house and watch Amelie.
You don't have to come to my house. This is a gift I'm giving you. And I don't. Oh. The thing is, right, I don't give a fuck about Amelie, but I want you to watch it, and I want you to have a conversation with your younger self, and I want you to pluck it out of your craw. If you said to your wife, hey, wife, let's watch Amelie tonight. Mate, afterwards, mate, you'll be, you know, this is a gift they'll keep on giving.
What are you saying? Are you orchestrating sex between me and my wife?
She will appreciate the fact that you've said, instead of me reading, or not even reading, listening to The Wheel of Time, part 10, let's sit down and watch Amelie together. She will go, oh my God, my husband is reaching out to me. He wants to sit with me and watch something that I might like.
I watch stuff that she might like all the time. Well, you won the round.
So where are we at now? I think you're still beating me.
Yeah, it's 3-2. It's 3-2.
Oh, he's nibbling back.
Annoyingly, though, you have taken Critical Acclaim off the table, which is a shame because my next film, And I Go First, has a 10 in Critical Acclaim. A 10. It's 1975's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. A newly admitted mental patient helps his docile companions defy the tyrannical head nurse. Obviously starring Jack Nicholson, directed by Milos Forman, written by a bunch of different people. This was, weirdly enough, this was my dad's favourite film. And I only ever watched it after he died because I thought, Milos, I only ever watched it after he died because I thought, oh, I should watch that. That's his favourite film. So it's difficult for me to separate it from that kind of emotional entanglement. I felt as though I've never really been able to have a firm grasp on whether this is a great film, whether I actually like it. You know, I don't feel as though I see it very objectively. It does have a 10 in Critical Acclaim here. It scores very highly in a number of other things as well, so I feel fairly confident. But would you like to say anything about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest before I select my category?
Well, that's one of the flicks when you're growing up. I always talk about it. It's my favourite thing to talk about when you're becoming a grubby little cineast. There's the homework. And back in the early 90s, the homework, you know, it was to be found in magazines like Empire, Total Film and Neon. And they always were churning out lists. That's where we got all our information back in the 90s, guys. It was in print media, and they were written by old geezers, and then they were always banging on about stuff like this. So you're like, oh, The Godfather. Oh, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, of course. All right, I better watch this. And yeah, you know, it's a very... I watched it then maybe once, and then I would have watched it in my early 20s, and I've never really revisited it. I've read the book of the same name, written by Ken Kesey. It's not called Written by Ken Kesey. It's called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Imagine a book called Written by Ken Kesey.
Apparently there's a little bit of a backlash to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest for the misogyny.
Right.
And the character, you know why he's in that. You know why he's in the mental hospital?
Is it presumably because he's deliberately chosen to go there so that he doesn't have to do real time in hard prison?
Yeah, but do you know what the crime is?
No. Is it sexual assault?
Yeah.
I didn't know that, no. I don't remember. I haven't seen the film for a long time.
It's statutory rape.
Right.
And then how it demonises the what's
Nurse she called? Ratched.
Nurse Ratched. But it's got...
She is terrible, though, Nurse Ratched, isn't she? She's really terrible.
It also, the way it depicts electroshock therapy, apparently isn't accurate.
Right.
Apparently electroshock therapy can be quite useful sometimes. Right. But again, I know nothing about that. These are things that I've kind of picked up piecemeal from various different articles over the years. And you can take a lot of what I'm saying with a grain of salt. Yeah. Not just you, but the listeners.
I think, I'm glad that you've said that. But also I will say that I think of all the people I know, you're someone who doesn't really need to offer that caveat or that disclaimer. Because I think it's sort of inherent in who you are as a person.
Yeah, well, I hope so, because I don't want to be held to account for stuff I just think and say.
Nor should you, to be honest. I'm going to take a little bit of a risk here.
Career catalyst.
Yeah.
Surely.
I am picking career catalyst.
Is this not launching Jack Nick?
It is. It's a slight risk, because the score is only 8, and there are higher scores here. I just think there are more films on my list that are likely to have... a higher score for fan-based loyalty. And I think Career Catalyst is a bit of a rarer catch. So even though it is only an 8, I'm going to take a risk and hope that you don't have a film that's launched a career like Jack Nicholson's.
That was the right pick. You've snuck in, because I had The Exorcist, 1973 horror smash. Weirdly, Colin's given it Franchise Impact 1. Which is an absolute fucking nonsense, because there's so many sequels to The Exorcist.
Carlin!
You can't. You're making me doubt your scores, you idiot. Critical Acclaim, 8.
Eight, yeah. Huh? That seems a little low. Did it have nine or higher for fanbase loyalty?
Nine.
Wow. Okay. So it would have been a draw. Would have been a draw.
You know, Career Catalyst, it's only got a six because it's not really launching anyone.
Yeah.
So you got it beat. You seen The Exorcist? You're not really a horror guy, right?
Nah, I haven't seen it.
I think you'd like it because it's all about vibe.
Oh yeah.
You know, and tone.
And isn't it about little girls turning their heads around like owls?
Although it goes back to that thing I said about Halloween. The Exorcist has been so ruined and parodied and talked about, the scary bits, like the head spinning and the projectile vomit. There's something quite laughable about that. And I saw it, there was a re-release of it when I was in my early 20s. I saw it in Aylesbury, late night showing. And I came out at midnight and everything was freezing and I could see my breath, and that's a thing in The Exorcist. But the key moments that have been ripped off and joked about in The Exorcist, they are quite hokey. But it's such a long, intense film that the overall effect is deeply unsettling. And
yeah,
it's, you know.
I don't want anything to do with it. Absolutely not. I'm not interested. All I know is that Mark Kermode thinks it's the greatest film ever. And that's enough for me to go, yeah, sure, I'm sure it's great. But no Dankeschön.
Yeah, mate, just stop talking about it. When someone talks about a movie that amount, like, you don't hear me talking about, like, Memento that much at all.
When was the last time you heard from your father?
When was the last time you heard from your father?
Daddy.
Oh, it's round six, seven now. It's round seven. It's your turn to pick. Let me tell you, Adam. Yeah, I mean, if I win one more, then you can't win. So this one's very important. What have you got?
Well, it's one of your favourite films, and it's a film I've never seen, and it's a stinker of a card. It's Out of Africa.
it's a tremendous film.
Don't care, because it's the scores suck. I've made my Out of Africa jokes last time.
Sure. You're all spent on Out of Africa. Let me tell you, if it had a vibes category, Out of Africa's scoring 10.
You know, I think what I might do. Do you know what? I'd say it's the most rubbish of all categories. Let's just play it. It's social and political impact. I've not seen it. I imagine it had some kind of social impact. It's a 7.
Oh,
let's go 7. Out of Africa.
Oh, so close. Okay, I'm going to tell you first. That I imagine there'll be some social and political impact that will relate to I guess race relations. Meryl Streep. I mean, I think it's a little outdated now. The thing for me that is more memorable about the film and about the character is that she is a truly independent woman in cinema. She arrives in Africa as this young, kept wife who doesn't know anything and needs looking after. And by the end of the film, she is just one of the coolest film characters of all time. I think she's so independent, and that relates directly to the sort of on-again, off-again love story that she has with Robert Redford in the film. So I can see why social and political impact, you have a 7. Sadly for me, I had a 6 for mine. I was hoping we might get a little draw there. My film is another one that I really enjoy. It's from 1984, and it's Amadeus. Amadeus is a film I think I've only rewatched once, and I would, based on how much I like it, I would have rewatched it more. It's just so long that I never really want to, and I never get around to it. But the two times I watched it, I really, really loved it. And it's always on the list of something that, oh, maybe we should watch that of a weekend. Critical acclaim, Amadeus gets another 10. That's another big boy. But overall, its total score is only 61, so it's not a super powerful card. So the point is yours. It's 4-3. Round 8, yes. It's my go first. So it's from 2007, and it's my third film in a row that scores 10 for critical acclaim.
Crikey, what's coming out in 2007? One other clue. Give me one other clue.
These male pensioners don't have a state.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's No Country for Old Men.
That's right.
Who's it by? What's it about? Tell the audience.
Violence and mayhem ensue after a hunter stumbles upon the aftermath of a drug deal gone wrong and over $2 million in cash near the Rio Grande. Starring, of course, Tommy Lee Jones, Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin. It is a Coen Brothers movie. And it's based on a book of the same name. No, it's not called Based On. It is by Cormac McCarthy, right? We've talked about it a number of times on this podcast before. I think it's one of the best films ever made. A true masterpiece. And it's very deserving of its 10 in critical acclaim.
But you can't pick that, can you?
I can't pick that, Adam. You're absolutely right. I also can't pick rewatchability, which has 9. I can't pick cultural penetration, which has 8, but I can pick box office, and I'm going to have to because it's my best remaining option. Box office is 8 for No Country for Old Men. So I'm just hoping that you don't have a big banger on your list.
Well, this is fucked. This is absolutely fucked. The score that I've been given for my film, that... this is nonsense. How does your film beat my film on box office? I've got Spirited Away.
My movie took $171 million gross worldwide.
Yeah, Spirited Away. I know for a fact it bust the fucking shit out of that.
I'm going to look. I'm looking now. Well, your film, Spirited Away, made $358 million gross worldwide. But Colin says my score is 8. And what does Colin say your score is?
Well, the score that I've pasted over, it says 7. But when I ask him to rescore, it's different.
Interesting, though, because in the document that you sent me...
Yeah, I know. That's final. That's final. But
is it? Can it be final?
No, it is.
But how can I beat you in box office if your film made twice as much money as mine?
You know, yeah, I don't know. I just, I'm happy to, we always, that was, that's the gentleman's agreement of
the gentleman's agreement was that Colin's word is final. If Colin's rescored them since, and there was clearly an error here, I don't want a hand-me-down victory. My movie made half as much as yours, so obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've lost that one, right?
Okay. You're an absolute pro.
It's not a gimme. I don't want a gimme. Okay, there will be no gimmies here. No. We will go on pure numbers alone.
Let's talk about the movies because this is the first time, you know, these are two top heavyweights that are going toe to toe in different realms.
Yeah,
this is apples and oranges. How do you even talk about these two films against each other?
Well, we could start by saying that Spirited Away is, during her family's move to the suburbs, a sullen 10-year-old girl wanders into a world ruled by gods, witches, and spirits, and where humans are changed into beasts. Directed by Hayao Miyazaki.
A Ghibli or Ghibli film, depending on your... on whether you like to say it correctly or incorrectly. I won't say which is which. I'll let you decide. One of these films made me cry, and makes me cry pretty much every time, and the other one doesn't.
Yeah. Javier Bardem's performance is very moving. I agree with you. They are two of the best films ever made. They serve, in some ways, two very different desires in me, and also the same desires. You know, it's they are the definition of films that transcend their genre. And not only are they relaxing in some ways and compelling and... easy to watch, they're also incredibly dense and textured, and I mean they're just masterpieces, both in their own ways and in the same way. And I don't know that we could do justice to any kind of comparison.
Right? Yeah. I mean, it's like they're both perfect. They're both 5-starers.
Yep. Absolutely.
They're both in my top 10. They're both probably, yeah.
I think they're both in my top 10 as well.
So.
Wow. Bask in it. Bask. Simply bask in it. Say hello to my little friend! Well, unfortunately, that mano-y-mano has left us at 4-4. So either...
Jesus Christ.
If someone can win the next two, they win. If not, it's a draw and we go on to our tiebreaker.
Here we go. Right. My go. Oh, okay. Here we go.
Now, it's worth saying at this point that the only categories remaining, because there are only two, of course, are fan-based loyalty and franchise impact.
So here we go. I've got 2019's Bong Joon-ho directed Parasite.
Oh, okay.
Act like you own the place. All unemployed, Ki Taek's family takes peculiar interest in the wealthy and glamorous Parks for their livelihood until they get entangled in an unexpected incident. I'm really looking forward to one day doing this flick for the podcast. I've only saw it the once when it came out. It feels plumb forgotten. Forgot. People love it. Obviously, it doesn't have any franchise impact at all. We're going to fan-based loyalty. Oh, this is a good number.
Is it?
It's a good number. It's 10.
It's 10?
It's 10.
10?
It's 10. People do love this film.
That's insane.
It seems high, but come on.
It seems high. 10. You get Colin to explain himself right this minute. Because I've got Mad Max Fury Road and I've only got 9.
They feel the same, don't they?
They definitely feel the same. Get Colin to explain why they're not the same.
Oh, Fury, this is a great pairing. Isn't Chance amazing?
Chance would be a fine thing if it favoured me.
Okay, here we go. Global breakout moment. Parasite wasn't just loved, it became a movement. The first non-English Best Picture winner. Fans worldwide rallied behind it. Cross-demographic love, cinephiles, general audiences and critics all passionately embraced it.
I can't argue with any of
long-tail fandom. It sparked a wave of Bong Joon-ho retrospectives, memes, merchandise, fan art and think pieces. Symbol of progress, many fans attached meaning beyond the film, representing changing Hollywood, diversity and global recognition. Why Fury Road scores a 9? Deep cult love. Fury Road has huge support from genre fans. Sure. Action lovers. Filmmakers and critics. That's just deep. It's not rich. Long-standing legacy
boost. All right,
shut up.
Mad Max fans are incredibly
loyal.
I agree. I can't disagree with any of it. Colin seems to be completely spot on. I couldn't see it before through my anger. I think that's fine. I'm going to wrap things up now, Adam, because you're on 5, I'm on 4. The only category left is franchise impact, and unfortunately, my next film is Juno with a 0. So either we're going to a draw, and you also have 0 on your next film, and we can do a whatever the thing is, or we can do a decider. Or you have one or above.
Yeah.
What have you got?
I've got Inside Out.
Oh my God!
Which is... I think there's a sequel. I think there's a sequel.
I think the times we live in are very stressful. And people want to laugh. You know, they want to... enjoy themselves, you know, forget their worries, and things are a little silly, you know.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. You've won the fucking game. You've snuck it at the last, like exactly like you do whenever we play chess. I'm absolutely furious about it, and I will say no more on the topic. But I will play this game again, and I'm going to keep doing it until I beat you.
Can I just say that we're doing these because it's a great format that people really vibe, but it also means that if we get caught short and we don't have time to watch one of the movies you forgot, we can just do the Top Trumps game. You'll do this again?
Yeah, these are really fun. I really enjoy these, and also it gives us an opportunity to talk about other films. I met a couple of people at the Soho theatre live show that you attended the other day, who said that they really liked...
You were phenomenal, by the way.
Thank you very much. They said that they really liked this podcast too, but all of them agreed that when they haven't seen the film, they don't watch the episode. And I think it is, we all acknowledge that it is the crucial flaw if your aim is to grow an audience, which ours isn't really. Ours is just to please ourselves, so it doesn't really matter. But it's a nice happenstance when we do get to do these episodes, because it does mean that if there's a chunk of listeners who are kind of into it and looking out for episodes that they can listen to and participate in, then these ones are very accessible in a way that asking people to do cheaper by the dozen maybe isn't.
And but yeah, thanks for listening. Also, can I add, I always ask people to follow me on Letterboxd at Error of Ways. I'm on Instagram now at Error of Ways as well. I've had to get on there because you know, for my comedy journey, for my stand-up comedy journey. So if you do give a shit, you could boost my numbers from 12 followers to a bit more.
Have you posted any of your videos on there?
I have, yeah.
Oh my God, I've got to get following you.
Two examples, and along with some other art collage shit I did during COVID and when I was having a little bit of a breakdown. So... and then, yeah, email us moviesyouforgot@gmail.com for suggestions for the podcast. Most influential movies or movies you forgot, you know, or general praise or, you know, pulling our pants down. All is welcome. That's it. Joe, say goodbye.
I'm just looking for Error of Ways on Instagram. Okay. Oh, I found you. Oh, you want to follow me? I confirm. And I follow back. It's good.
Great.
There lines. You are. There's a little video of you. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, see you later.
Bye.
That'll do, Pig. That'll do.